ask you this. Let me ask you this.
What in the wide, wide world of sports is going on here?
Sports Central. Chicago Sports Conversation with Adam Hogue.
Go, 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 go.
This is Sports Central. On demand and streaming live on WGNRadio.com.
Hello, happy Monday. Welcome in. This is Sports Central. It is Monday, March 5th, 2018. 312-235-2525. My name is Adam Hogue. You can find Sports Central on iTunes, the Google Play Store. Tune in pretty much anywhere where you listen to your podcasts if you don't listen to the show live, which, of course, you can do 1 to 2 p.m. every day on WGNRadio.com. Got a good show for you today. We'll talk a little bit about the weekend, some of the highlights, some of the lowlights. And before we jump into an obvious highlight, Joe, here's the low light for me for the weekend. I find the Oscars to be just incredibly boring. So boring.
Is it just because we're sports fans?
I don't think so, because I don't mind award shows. I actually find the Grammys relatively entertaining, just because I like the music performances. This goes for all award shows. I don't find anything entertaining about you win an award, the guy comes up to the stage, gives the same speech that everybody else gives, names a bunch of people no one's ever heard of, and then goes away. That's the whole award show. Now, there are some parts that are good. I did not see the Eddie Vedder performance last night, but I'm sure I would have enjoyed that. I like Eddie Vedder. I like music. I like live performances. But what was that? 5 of the 3.5 hour marathon? 5 minutes of it? It's not worth sitting there through.
Yeah, and I don't know, man. I mean, I didn't make it all the way to the end. Is that how long it was? 3.5 hours?
Well, I went to bed at 10:30 and I felt like it was still going on on when I'm checking Twitter right before I went to bed.
I mean, all the commercials, I think the best way to consume that would just be to DVR it and watch it. I mean, I wouldn't care about spoiler alerts because I don't care who wins and all that stuff. I thought there were a couple good jokes, but that was not worth my time last night. Not that it's precious or anything, but it was not worth my time.
Yeah, I forgot it was Oscar night, and then when I found out at about 4, I was like, nah. Honey, we don't have to watch this, do we? And then we didn't watch it. I worked on Bears Mock Draft 2.0 for most of those 3 hours.
Can't wait.
Got a lot of work done. It's coming out tomorrow, WGNRadio.com. And you know what? I'm not afraid to give a little
teaser.
Speaking of spoiler alert, if you look at my Twitter feed from the last 24 hours, good chance you might figure out who I have the Bears taking at number 8. At Adam Hogue, H-O-G-E. And by the way, another highlight of the weekend, shout out to the Bridgeport, Chicago Fire Department based out of Bridgeport. They allowed my buddy's son, who's turning 4, for his birthday, basically had his birthday party in the fire department, let the kids do everything. Took him on a ride on the fire truck, like went around the block, actually in the fire truck, which is awesome. So James was there, and just, I mean, you want to see a bunch of kids get really, really happy, really fast, just take them to a fire station. It's awesome.
I wanted to be a firefighter for most of my life. Actually, I started out wanting to be the ambulance, not a paramedic, but the actual truck.
Okay.
And then
that's a hard career.
Yeah, that would be tough, unless, you know, that whole Transformers thing came to be real.
Which we might not be that far off. Mm-hmm. Do you see some of the robots they're making in Korea?
Crazy.
That's scary.
So, I shadowed a firefighter when I was in 8th grade. It's just a great group of guys, you know what I'm saying?
If you look at my Instagram, at Adam Hogue on Instagram, just the excitement of a 3.5-year-old and a fire truck. It's the greatest. So that was definitely the highlight of the weekend for me, and low light being the Oscars. Just don't care about it. How about in the sports world, though, a great local story as we jump into today's lead with Loyola clinching an NCAA tournament berth.
First of all, I want to give all the grace and glory to God. It's been so good to me, keeping the faith. He's had a plan, and I first want to say that. Second of all, I'm blessed to coach great kids. I think doing this the right way with great kids, you look at the, you know, the enthusiasm of Loyola University. When I took this job, I said, I'm a Catholic kid from Chicago. How cool would this be to get Loyola to the NCAA tournament? And now here we are. So it's a blessing, and I'm blessed to have really, really good guys and really good players.
Talk to me about the game plan. I noticed you kept telling your team to keep pushing the pace, keep pushing the pace. How much was that due to the fact that Illinois State played an overtime game last night?
Well, we've been trying to really get stronger the second half. We call it body blows. Just keep pushing it. And our guys were confident. I mean, just pushing the pace, getting it, you know, play with space and pace. And, you know, our guys, I really believe they're in great condition. And I'm just happy. They believe. They've talked about it the whole year. Even through all the accolades they got, they were still chasing. We've had this theme of no finish line. And I can't tell you what it means to me to see them. I told them, you know, when I was a player at Creighton, we were up there. And I said, it'll connect you the rest of your life. This will connect you the rest of your life. And I'm just so happy for them that they're experiencing this right now, because that is an unbelievable feeling.
There's Porter Moser, the head coach of the Loyola Ramblers. That was on CBS Sports Network after Loyola beat Illinois State. The state of Illinois was guaranteed to get a team in because the Final Four from the Missouri Valley Conference Tournament were all Illinois teams. But to get a team from inside the city, it's been a really long time since that has happened. Loyola's first NCAA tournament berth since 1985. We're going to talk a little bit about Loyola, some of the other things going on. I want to touch on the Big Ten tournament and some of the tournaments coming up this week. Brian Hamilton covers college basketball for The Athletic. He joins us now on Sports Central. What's going on, Brian?
How are you?
I'm good, man. It's good to talk to you again. And by the way, congratulations on The Athletic success. Another announcement today that you guys are getting $20 million in funding. I assume you get half of that, right?
That's right. That's actually was a contractual obligation for that. I get half of any massive round of funding moving forward. So big day for The Athletic, the Fieldhouse, and obviously my bank account.
Yeah, well, so. If you're not subscribed to The Athletic, you should be. I am. It's a great resource for all sports. And, of course, Brian's part of the Fieldhouse, which is their college basketball platform. So let's start with Loyola, since it's the big local story. I do want to hit on the Big Ten tournament and some of the other stories in college basketball right now. But just the your reaction, you've covered college basketball for a long time in this city and Loyola to make it, and actually they seem like a dangerous team in the tournament a little bit too, to win one or two games.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't want to play them. I mean, they're going to be an 11 or a 12 seed probably, and if I am a 5 or a 6 and that name pops up on the line across from me in the pod, I would be terrified immediately. I mean, they're going to be one of the trendy picks to upset someone in the first round and move forward. I mean, it's because they're just a super balanced team in any way. I mean, it's remarkable. At 5 double-digit scorers, they shoot the ball incredibly well. As we sit here, I think they're top 5 in the country in field goal percentage overall. You look at some of the defensive metrics for them. That's a top 25 team defensively. When you look at our friend Ken Pomeroy's adjusted defensive statistics, so they're going to be a team that's going to make it hard on you because they're going to take advantage of their opportunity. When they get easy opportunities, they're not going to blow them, and they're going to make life fairly difficult for you on the other end of the floor. So, yeah, I think this is going to be a team that is picked to pull some of those first-round upsets and maybe even go farther. It could be a trendy Cinderella pick moving forward, because I think they're going to be a lot better than what their seed is.
And they proved early on in the season that they can beat a top-tier team winning at Florida. So right, that has to give them a little bit of confidence, too. How about Porter Moser here? You know, he's been at Loyola for a while. He's kind of built this thing up year by year, and this year they finally break through with a veteran team. Obviously, as soon as you have a mid-major that has a big season, that coach gets put on a list, and you watch out for them getting a job. Have you heard anything about Porter Moser potentially getting interest from other schools coming up here? Is it just too early for that?
Yeah, I think it's a little too early, because I think if you're Porter Moser and you even consider this stuff, we don't know what all the Power Five openings are right now. And I would doubt that he would go anywhere except for a really good situation in a Power Five league. He's been there long enough and has put down enough roots at Loyola, and frankly has enough coming back next year to probably wait it out and see if he gets the perfect opportunity for him. A lot of those Power Five jobs don't really open up maybe until after conference tournaments. I mean, the next couple of weeks, I think we'll see some things coming around. I mean, there have been reports from ESPN that Thad Matta, the former Ohio State coach, has been down at Ole Miss talking to them because they're already moving on from Andy Kennedy. But once the Power Five jobs open up, then you can sort of connect the dots to what might be a good fit for him. I think he should get a look. He's certainly built up a team over time that, again, solid on both sides of the ball. I mean, you don't have to hire a defensive coach. You don't have to hire an offensive coach. He's got a team that's doing it on both ends. So, you know, they're probably going to have to fight a little bit to keep him, but I do think it'll have to be a really, really good situation to draw him out of there.
This is probably getting off into a little bit of an early tangent, but I find the idea of a coaching carousel interesting this year, given what's going on in the sport and these investigations everywhere. A coach considering any job is going to really have to do their homework and dig deep before they consider taking on any open job, especially because let's see what these open jobs are, and are they a result of these investigations?
Yeah, and I was talking to actually a current Power Five coach about that recently, and we both wondered if there might be less openings than you would think in a normal year, just because schools might be less inclined to go out there and try to find somebody who's squeaky clean, to try to go through that process and take a risk on a guy that who knows what skeletons jump out of the closet down the line. I mean, you do your homework, you hire search firms, you do background checks, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee you anything. And so do you get another year if you're a coach on the hot seat just because your school is a little, you know, gun shy about making a change and going down the road of trying to find someone who's clean and you never know? I mean, I think that's very real. I mean, you look at a guy like Mark Fox at Georgia, I think the writing might be on the wall that he's gone, but maybe Georgia says, unless we've got a slam dunk candidate in the back, do we really want to wade into this thing and hire somebody and then somewhere down the line just get knocked over by some, you know, FBI related investigation nugget popping up. So it'll be interesting. Nothing ever surprises me, but I do wonder if a few guys who might otherwise lose their job in other years, I wonder if they hang on a little bit just for another year to see what happens when the dust settles.
He's Brian Hamilton. He covers college basketball for The Athletic. You know, going into this past weekend, even Jim Delaney was kind of conceding that this idea of the Big Ten tournament being held in Madison Square Garden was a mistake. I talked to some people who were there all weekend, and they said it was great for those that were there. It was entertaining. Most of the games were entertaining, and it was a good atmosphere. Still, though, looking at it from the outside, to me, it still seems weird that, A, it was held in a state that doesn't even have a Big Ten team, and, B, it's over. I mean, some people think, all right, it was good for them to kind of get their own spotlight in this weekend where all the other Power Five conferences didn't have a tournament. But, I don't know, going into this weekend, to me, this is when college basketball is really heating up this week, and the Big Ten's just sitting on the sidelines.
Yeah, I think the real trade-off here is, I think focusing on, you know, fannies in the seats and the crowds at Madison Square Garden isn't really the crux of the matter. The issue is you condensed your season. The issue is you had teams playing like 3 games in 7 days, and you had playing on weird days, and guys weren't getting any rest. You pushed everything up, hurried everything up in your season, in your conference season, to get this thing happening at Madison Square Garden. Obviously, having a successful event there is important in some ways, but I think the trade-off of what you had to do to your teams and, frankly, how much you kind of ticked off all the coaches in your league by creating this completely compressed schedule that just, I mean, it wore some guys out. Like, you'd see coaches around the league, and they just sort of tell you about, we've got X games and X days, and they just shake their head. I mean, what are they going to say? You know, the die is cast. not going to change anything at the last minute. This is what was going to happen, but they weren't happy about it. And it was an open secret that nobody was happy about it. So I'm not sure the trade-off was worth it. I think the atmosphere was probably really good. I think there's a plus there. I think that's a success. That's a check mark in Jim Delaney's column. But I do think all the other stuff he had to put his teams and his coaches through is going to make him think really long and really hard about ever doing this kind of thing again.
So give me a snapshot of where the Big Ten sits here with the NCAA tournament coming up. There's no doubt that Michigan State's still a really, really talented team, one of the most talented teams in the country. Michigan's heated up at the right time. Purdue, kind of hard to figure out right now, but maybe the rest will actually help them. And then you got to, I don't know, do you have a couple bubble teams in Nebraska or Penn State or not?
Yeah, I think Nebraska and Penn State are on the bubble, but I'm not real sure they're going to get in. I think Nebraska needed maybe another win or two. I think Penn State probably needed to beat Purdue, make it to the final, have a real solid chance at it. I think we're going to see four Big Ten teams in the field. Could be wrong. I mean, you never know how the committee is evaluating things, but everything you look at from everybody on the outside seems to say that it's going to be four. Michigan is an extremely dangerous team because I think people were making the argument that they're hard to prepare for in a tournament environment. In the Big Ten tournament, I'm not sure how that applies because Big Ten teams prepare for them all year. But I do think the way they play defense and the way John Beilein runs his offense, especially the way they play defense this year, they are playing at a much higher level. That's going to be a tricky team to deal with in the NCAA tournament. That, again, might be another trendy pick to kind of move farther in the bracket than you might have thought. I think they've been really good all year. It's not like a surprise that they're a good team, but the way they run their offense, what they do, how they move, and the way they've become a pretty really solid defensive team and just gotten, opposing guards, especially Xavier Simpson, just getting opposing guards out of whatever they want to do, they're going to be tough to deal with. Michigan State just terrifies me from a basketball perspective because I think they could run out there and beat two or three teams by 25 or 30 points in a row when they're clicking and then just completely be a no-show in the next game. I think they are as deep and as talented as any team in the country, but how often do they bring their best effort? How often do they bring their A game? That consistency hasn't been there all year. If they can do it for five games, they're in the Final Four. They're in the championship. But I don't know that they can do that. They haven't proven that they've been that consistent all year long with that top effort. They can get by with a little bit of B effort in a lot of times, but not as you move along in the NCAA tournament.
Yeah, how much did the so-called down Big Ten play into that long winning streak that they had, and would have had more trouble in other seasons when the conference was much deeper? So set us up for some big storylines this week. I know you're going to the SEC tournament, but even beyond the SEC, what are you looking for this week as the big conferences have their conference tournaments?
Yeah, I don't know that you're going to look, I think, mostly as always down to the bubble team, but I don't think a lot of teams are going to make too much hay here, jumping up two or three seed lines at the top. I think your number one and number two lines are, maybe one team flips up and down a little bit, but it's not going to be that much of a dramatic change. But all those teams down on the bubble, your Alabamas, can they make a run in the SEC tournament? And honestly, the one thing I'm looking forward to in the SEC tournament is whether Michael Porter Jr. plays. I've said all along, since he played 2 minutes in the season opener, and everybody started talking about him coming back to help Mizzou down the stretch, I've always said I'll believe it when I see it, and we've had false alarm after false alarm after false alarm with him getting back, cleared for practice, getting into practice. Everyone thought he was going to play Saturday in Missouri's home finale. Turns out it was his decision not to. Didn't feel right, didn't feel ready to go. So I'll be curious to see if he jumps in the mix in St. Louis in the SEC tournament. Could be a really transformative guy. Could be a guy that gets in the way for a Mizzou team that's had a really good chemistry so far this year, and should make the tournament under Konzo Martin in his first season. So that's the big one to me. I'm interested to see what happens in St. Louis. Will MPJ be in there, or will we just see another series of false alarms?
Do you have your one seeds locked up, or can those change this week?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you can. I mean, I guess if Xavier falls flat or Kansas falls flat in the Big 12 tournament and Xavier in the Big East tournament, can a Duke make a run in the ACC tournament? Can North Carolina make a run in the ACC tournament that elevates them to a one seed? I don't know. I think it's going to be really hard to displace, Villanova, Virginia, Xavier and Kansas, I mean, you look at their resumes, they're pretty solid. So you're going to need a run from an Auburn. You're going to need a run from a Carolina or a Duke to really just rev up and get to that top line. It's an interesting battle, as our guy Stu Mandel pointed out this week. You know, Virginia might be headed towards to Charlotte, North Carolina, by the way they set up the geographic seeds. Duke and North Carolina may be locked here in a battle over the last week or so to get that much preferred short trip down to Charlotte with the friendly crowds in the first couple rounds of the NCAA tournament, and another one's going to get shipped to like Nashville or Pittsburgh or something like that. So it could be sort of a small addition to the rivalry to see who goes farther in the ACC tournament between Duke and Carolina, who gets to play closer to home starting the next week in the NCAA tournament.
And that always matters to the fan bases. They like to make those trips when they can, and when you got to go across the country, it makes it a lot harder. All right, Brian, I appreciate you jumping on today, and hoping for continued success with The Athletic. We enjoy reading you, so keep it up.
All right, man. Appreciate you having me on. Thanks.
All right, Brian Hamilton from The Athletic, covering college basketball at the Fieldhouse Vertical. Must read, especially here this month with NCAA tournament action heating up. You know, one last note before we take a break, and we're going to talk to Eric Edholm from Pro Football Weekly to kind of wrap up the NFL Combine here shortly. But Brian touched on it. I have to say, the tournament in New York City this weekend went better than I thought. The crowds were good. The games were good. The thing about New York is it's certainly not as much of a Big Ten melting pot as Chicago is, because we're here in the Midwest, but there's still a ton of alumni out there for all these schools. Michigan, Northwestern, even. When we were out there for the Pinstripe Bowl 2 years ago, there were a ton of Northwestern fans there. You know, Wisconsin has a lot of fans there. You certainly heard it with the Michigan crowds the last 2 days, with them playing as well as they did. So that's all great. It worked out better than I honestly, you know, if we talked about this Thursday and Friday, and we did a little bit, wasn't feeling too good about that. But was it worth all the problems it created throughout the season? And that's the problem, especially because we're about to go to a 20-game Big Ten schedule. It's about to get even more congested than it already is. And you had the two random Big Ten games at the beginning of December, which was necessary to cram in the whole slate. But even beyond that, Brian talked about it. You had some teams playing three games in a week when usually you're trying for two. You had random stretches of like 5 out of 6 road games. And you forget that these guys are students, that they do have class to go to. And it's a lot to cram in. And then someone brought this up to me last week. I didn't even think about it. The Big Ten women's tournament is always played this past weekend, 1 week before the men's tournament. So this year it overlapped. They were played at the same time. Well, that women's tournament is always on the Big Ten Network. But you had all these games on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday on the Big Ten Network, these men's games. So for those days, the women's tournament wasn't televised. Now, I understand that most people listening to this are probably going, well, who cares? But those families care. Those players care. The coaches care. They want to get their product out there as much as possible. So you had this trickle-down effect, too. Now, the coaches, the women's coaches, actually had an opportunity to vote to move their tournament to next week. Then it would have been on TV. And my understanding is all the coaches except one, Joe McEwen at Northwestern, said keep it where it is, because they didn't want to deal with adjusting their whole routine, because they're always used to having this week off in between. So the trickle-down effect was huge, of just this forced thing of getting in Madison Square Garden. I'm glad it worked out. I'm glad it was fun. But guess what? It's fun every year in Indianapolis. It's fun every year here in Chicago. There's no difference. It's going to be back at the United Center next year. And I say this all the time. Indy's the best spot for it. I love when it's here in Chicago. Makes it easier for me to go to. But Indy is the best spot. It's a smaller town. It's all condensed downtown. All the hotels are there. It's a great venue at Bankers Life Fieldhouse. And every team has like a bar that's right, you know, a signed bar, and it's all walking distance. The problem here in Chicago, love Chicago. I'm sure fans love coming here for the tournament, but everything's more expensive. It's not condensed to the area. No one's staying by the United Center. You got to get back and forth. Not the biggest deal in the world, but it is different. But it doesn't need to be in New York. Doesn't need to be in Washington, D.C. But I don't think we're done with it.
Oh, it's definitely going back out east. I just don't think they'll ever do it a week early like they did this year. You know, go to the Barclays Center, go back to D.C. I don't know. Do something out there. I just don't think they'll totally adjust their schedule. I think it was really cool to be at Madison Square Garden, but it's not worth it to put all this stress on these players. And, you know, not to be a homer, but who knows what would have happened with Northwestern if the schedule wasn't the way that it was.
Yeah. It could have been different. I think they had some other issues that it just wasn't going to add up this year, but that was a factor. We talked to Teddy Greenstein about that last week. Schedule didn't help. Allstate Arena didn't help. All right, we'll take a quick time out here. We'll dive into some football talk. Got plenty to cover from the combine over the weekend, including one incredibly awesome story that we're going to talk to Eric Edholm about. He was there in Indy for pretty much the whole thing. In fact, he may still be there. I think he came home. I hope he's not still there. No one should have to be there that long. Although the team certainly are. We'll take a quick time out. Be right back on Sports Central.
WGN. This is where WGN Sports Central lives. It's alive! Streaming right now with your host, Adam Hogue.
Welcome back, Sports Central, here after a busy weekend of NFL Combine action. Probably spent more time than I should have watching the television coverage over the weekend. Somehow you just kind of get mesmerized with all these 40 times and bench presses, but there were some good storylines and some legitimate questions that came up to help answer those questions. Eric Edholm from Pro Football Weekly joins us now on Sports Central. What's up, Eric?
Yeah, I'm like you, man. I kind of sit there and think I'm going to get other things done. It's like Twitter. You know, you have a hard time taking your eyeballs off what's going on at the combine drills.
Yeah, well, I mean, for something that is actually should be really boring to watch, I mean, the NFL Network does a really good job of spicing it up with player comparisons and highlights. I like when Mayock's breaking down the film in between 40s. So you actually learn a lot watching the combine, and you certainly learn a lot, as Eric and I both know, from just being at the combine, being in Indy. The old saying is you learn a lot during the day, you learn even more at night.
I as long as I can remember to go to the ATM before I go out, that helps me learn more things, you know, buying people drinks and, you know, getting the drinks flowing and the lips flapping. That always helps.
So let's start with Shaquem Griffin, because this is just such a great story. For those that don't know, and we've talked about him before here on the show, he's missing a hand that he lost at birth. He's played football without it. He's was an incredible player at Central Florida without the hand, and originally was not invited to the NFL Combine. And eventually that changed. There was some public pressure that probably played a role in that. But not only does he show up at the Combine, but he did an amazing job. He benched 19 reps of 225 with one hand, and he ran a 4.38, which was incredible for a linebacker.
Yeah, that time alone goes, you go, whoa. Because, I mean, if you watch him play, I mean, you see the burst and the acceleration, but, you know, it's a 227-pound guy. I didn't necessarily see a wide receiver speed. Okay. I mean, this is like Calvin Johnson speed or whatever, Julio Jones speed that he was running out there. So pretty remarkable stuff. A lot slower on his second time, 4.58. So there is that disparity. Some teams will, you know, average the two or, you know, maybe they'll check in on his pro day and see what he runs there. But he's, you know, Griffin's talking about running, you know, even better and having a better workout entirely. But, I mean, what he's done at this point, if you talk to people at UCF, I know somebody who spent some time there the last few years. First of all, most teams didn't want to give him a scholarship, but his brother, who plays for the Seahawks, his twin brother, said, "You want me?" And he was a highly touted kid coming out of South Florida. "You got to take my brother, too." And guess what? UCF and Scott Frost last year, they figured out this guy is a defensive menace. So missing a hand or not, he could play football. And we saw this weekend he can work out, too.
So, I mean, let's think about this practically. It's certainly a little bit of a disadvantage to be missing a hand. Now, he has shown at the college level he can play through it. He makes up for it in different ways. He has interceptions on his film that you could see, and they're impressive. I mean, look, if Brian Urlacher played with a club on one hand, he'd still be a really, really good football player. I'm not saying he's, you know, Shaquem Griffin's going to be Brian Urlacher, but I'm just saying, if you're good at playing linebacker, if you have the instincts and the natural ability, I still think you can play at a very high level at the NFL.
I do too. And he's learned, you know, this is something, I think the procedure he had to remove the hand was at age 4. So he has spent, you know, he's 22 years old now. He spent the last 18 years figuring out how to do things without this hand, you know, whether it's pull-ups, you know, whether it's you're using that prosthetic on the bench press, and also disengaging from blocks, you know, intercepting the ball. We saw him in the drills here on the field. You know, I mean, he doesn't catch it as naturally as guys with two hands do, but he found ways to kind of cradle the ball when it came in his direction. Other guys had far more drops than he did, which is just remarkable. So, yeah, you know, the Senior Bowl was interesting. They used him a little off the ball, and he was playing some safety that week too, so the Texans were trying to move him around and find some different ways to use him, you know. And as they, I think it was Phil Savage down there, said, at the very worst, he's going to be the kind of guy who runs down kickoffs and is a special teams demon for a decade. You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that he almost feels like a safe pick, because he's got such a big heart, such great athleticism, that you'll find a way to use him in some way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I always say this throughout the draft process over and over and over again. It just takes one general manager to take a chance on a guy. And with a 4-3-8 in times like that, this is a guy that's consistently showed doubters wrong at every single level, and something tells me he'll do that to at least, you know, become a serviceable player at the NFL level. Eric at Home writes for Pro Football Weekly. I have the draft magazine. If you should go out and buy it right now, it is it's in my hands. You can't buy it for me, but you can go out and get it. It's always a great resource with Greg Gabriel and all the scouting reports in here. I've been looking at it a lot over the last few days. Help me break down some of the other big combine stories here. I saw some interesting stuff with Minka Fitzpatrick today. Ran a slow 40, and then he picked it up right, because all of a sudden there was some doubt about whether or not this kid can be a top 10 player if he's not running fast.
Right. I mean, ran a 4.47, and it's not a blazing 40 time for a cornerback, but then I went back and looked, and, you know, guys his weight are heavier, you know, since 2000, so the last, you know, 18 combines. Only 41 that big or bigger have run faster. So it's not as if it's a terrible time. That puts him in about, for his size and bigger, that puts him in about the 75th percentile or 70th percentile. So, you know, it wasn't an ideal time, but had he been a 4.42, he would have been in the top 10%. So, you know, it's all relative. And some of his other workouts, I still have to look at some of the final numbers, but, you know, he certainly looked good. Derwin James, the other guy who's sort of seen as that, you know, could he be a press corner? Could he be a safety? Could he be both? You know, that hybrid, freaky athlete type. His numbers weren't eye-popping either, maybe the way some people expected. So, you know, again, they could go out at their pro days and blow it up. You know, maybe there's some lingering injury or something else that we don't know about. James is coming off surgery. But, you know, I still feel like these are two pretty fascinating DB specimens who can do a lot of things and will be good football players. So. Yeah, maybe not the mind-blowing numbers that we expected.
Yeah, both of those guys, most people think they can play either corner or safety. If you're a team, if you're a cornerback needy team like the Chicago Bears at number 8, let's say that you could have your choice between Minka Fitzpatrick, Derwin James, Josh Jackson, or Denzel Ward, which direction would you go?
Yeah, I mean, it depends, you know, obviously what direction they want to go. I mean, Denzel Ward put up some shockingly good numbers this week today. You know, the 40 drill, agility drills, the jumping. His broad jump, I think, was one of the best numbers we've seen in recent years among DBs, not named, you know, the Byron Jones, the kid from UConn a couple of years ago. I mean, other than him, I think he's up there among some of the elite guys. So, you know, for a 5'11 corner, you know, he better be able to run fast. That's the thing. That's not considered ideal size these days. So it obviously depends on what happens with Fuller and everything. But, yeah, I could see Ward being a possibility there. I really could. And I think Josh Jackson, even though his workout numbers were, you know, good but not great, he's got more of that length and he's got more of that press ability. He's only got the 1 year of full-time status at Iowa, but he showed a nose for the ball. You know, we saw how good Desmond King was last year for the Chargers. That's a school that produces some good DB talent. So I think there's a case to be made for Jackson as well, depending on the style of cornerback you want.
Follow him on Twitter at Eric_Edholm, Pro Football Weekly. What did we learn from the quarterbacks this week? Did anyone separate themselves a little bit?
Well, back to your point about learning more at night than we do during the day. There are a lot of people who are just fascinated by Josh Allen from Wyoming. This is the kid who, you know, what, completed 56% of his passes, 57, whatever the number was, in the Mountain West, right? Lost a lot of talent last year. That's a big reason why his numbers went down, suffered some drops, some bad protection, all that. But watching him throw, I mean, if you just go throw to throw, put him next to, Josh Rosen and Baker Mayfield and the other guys, Lamar Jackson, who threw. Allen threw the prettiest passes. And as the Senior Bowl went on, you saw the improvement day to day. He was a little erratic early, got better by the end of the week. But I absolutely believe he's in play for the Cleveland Browns, either first or fourth pick. I don't think first. That would probably result in some angry people. But if you told me they're going to take him number four, I wouldn't be shocked. I don't know if that means he's going to be the best guy. I think Josh Rosen looks the most polished. I think he looks like the most NFL ready. He looked, other than a couple of really bad throws, I thought he looked really, really good overall. But, you know, as you know, this is sort of one little sliver of the evaluation. The game tape's always going to sort of rule in that regard.
Okay, so let's talk about Josh Rosen. And actually, just a quick point on Josh Allen. The comparisons to Carson Wentz are, I like those comparisons because he played in the same offense. The same head coach was at North Dakota State when Carson Wentz was there. And I'm just thinking back to this point that year when Carson Wentz was coming out, I absolutely love Carson Wentz, and I'm still having questions about Josh Allen. So that tells me that there's still something missing there. I love the arm. How can you not? But it's not. Everything with Carson Wentz was fluid, and it was, you could tell the way he picked up the offense at the Senior Bowl in like one day and looked great with the, you know, stepping up in competition. Those were all the things I love about Carson Wentz, and I still am iffy on Josh Allen. As for Josh Rosen, I'm curious if you heard anything, behind the scenes on Rosen, because you love the mechanics, you love the ability, doesn't have the strongest arm, but he is very fluid in how he goes through his reads and completes throws, and he has the touch, which oftentimes is more important than arm strength. But I still can't find anybody, Eric, to just tell me, yeah, this stuff off the field's overblown. This stuff about him being a bad teammate's overblown. I haven't heard that, and that's continually concerning me.
Yeah, I'll say this. I talked to two different people on quarterback needy teams. I'll say it that way. There's one of the two that I don't think is going to be even in range to pick him, but they are looking at quarterbacks, and they did sit down with Rosen this weekend. So two teams that interview him, neither one of them felt like it was that big a deal. All the stuff about, you know, him sort of being a selfish me first guy, or him being, you know, focused on being a brand. You know, I mean, remember Cam Newton's favorite famous quote about, you know, I can't remember the exact words, but paraphrasing, he just said, I want to be this brand, right? And people took that negatively and people criticized him for it. I think Rosen's being put through the spin cycle on this one a little bit as well, where, you know, it's a little bit vague. There's some questions about, you know, whether he's going to be cocky or going to be that kind of Jay Cutler guy who will challenge coaches or this or that or whatever. I just haven't gathered that anything is too terribly serious either. I will say the one guy that I've talked to, his teammate granted, but still, Scott Questenberry, the guy who snapped the ball to him pretty much every snap the last couple of years, he passionately said it to me one-on-one at the Senior Bowl, and he did so again at the Combine. He said, I will put my reputation on the line for this guy. We worked together. We were tight. We didn't always agree. You know, we had our moments, but I love the competitor in him, and I love who he is. So that's really the one guy, non-NFL employee, who's done that.
Boy, I'll tell you, it's just from spending way too many years covering Jay Cutler, it just sounds very familiar.
Yeah. Yeah,
because he had guys. Absolutely. He had guys that Kyle Long would go to the grave defending that dude. But that doesn't mean that all 53 guys in there loved him. And we certainly have heard the other stories from guys that didn't, and the divisive nature in the locker room. And the problem is, at the NFL level, you and I both know the whole team has to rally around the quarterback. That's what you need.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt about that. So it's going to not just be the fit with whatever head coach, whatever offensive coordinator, whatever QB coach, all those different things. Those are important. But also where he goes. Some people think, if he went to Buffalo and he had to sit there in the cold winters and the small market and all that, he might be a little bit distracted or just not that interested in it. So, that's the kind of thing that you start thinking about. I'm not saying that if the Bills love him, they shouldn't draft him, but that may be more of a concern. The interesting thing, I'll keep this in mind, Jeremy Bates, as Lewis Cutler, all that, he's the Jets offensive coordinator. Jets need a quarterback. Kind of connected those two a few times. I just feel like that's Rosen to the Jets is one that makes a lot of sense to me, sort of given who he is, what he wants to be, and also somebody who's dealt with that kind of a headstrong quarterback before and can go toe-to-toe with him.
Be like Mark Sanchez 2.0, going from L.A. to...
Yeah, exactly.
last thing for you, Eric. Love talking football with you. The Cleveland Browns, unfortunately, kind of everything falls with the Cleveland Browns here, especially because they have not only the number one pick, which we're used to, but the number four pick, too. Two picks in the top four. Man, all of a sudden, there's a lot of talk about Saquon Barkley going number one overall, which... I actually love that idea, to be honest. Maybe the Browns can actually get something right for once. But there's just so much depends on what the Browns do. What are you hearing in terms of what they might actually do?
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. It's certainly one that they've discussed. I don't think there's any way at all they've ruled it out. And, would it go against some of the grain of what we've heard? Oh, you can get a Kareem Hunt in round three. You can get Alvin Kamara and, at the bottom of round two and all that. Yeah, those examples absolutely exist. But that should never prevent, in my opinion, never prevent you from taking what, if you believe somebody is truly special. Positional value can be overrated outside of quarterback. Yeah, you need pass rushers, you need, cornerbacks, all that good stuff. I agree. And that factors in, but don't pass on a special player with the hope that you can get someone who's pretty darn good in round three, because he may not be there. If he's there for the taking and you love him, you draft him. That's why I would connect those two. The old regime in Cleveland never would have taken Saquon Barkley because they did not place a high positional value on running back. They would have said, nope. You need a quarterback, you need a pass rusher, you need a corner, you need a big safety, whatever. So, or an offensive tackle, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, that's the difference between John Dorsey, the new GM, who I think is more of a talent guy. He's a grinder. He wants to find special players, and he took those kind of players when he was in Kansas City and other places like Green Bay before that. So I think it's a real thing. I think they'll sign A.J. McCarron. They'll get somebody special at one, non-QB, and then use that fourth pick to get their groom quarterback, their young guy they can bring up slowly.
Well, we'll see if they can actually get it right for once, but it'll be the trickle-down effect will be very, very interesting with what the Cleveland Browns do. Eric Edholm, you can follow him on Twitter, @Eric_Edholm. Read him, profootballweekly.com. Pick up this draft magazine. I'm staring at page 4. There's a big story on the quarterbacks from Eric, and, of course, all the scouting reports from Greg Gabriel. You guys do great work, and I guess I contribute a little bit with a column once a week on the website.
Don't sell yourself short, man. We love it. We love reading it.
My next one should be out Wednesday. So, and I know you got all the great work from Indy. So I appreciate you jumping on today, buddy.
All right, man. Sounds good. Talk to you soon.
All right. Eric Edholm @Eric_Edholm, Pro Football Weekly. We'll take a last time out, dive in with buried headlines, including just a weird story about John Lester. One of the most bizarre things in all of sports, in my opinion, and it just got weirder. Sports Central here on WGNRadio.com.
What?
Yes!
What?
No!
What?
Let me think.
Ooh.
Yeah!
Good talk, Coach. Thanks.
Maybe we should stick to radio.
He's got a point.
Chicago Sports Conversation. This is Sports Central with Adam Hogue.
All right, got about 10 minutes left here on the program today. And we'll dive into some buried headlines here. You know, John Lester's inability to throw the ball to first base. I get on guys who can't bunt. I get on guys that can't shoot free throws. Because I feel like at that high level, they're pretty simple things you should be able to do. But not being able to throw the ball to first base when you're a pitcher, you make your living throwing a ball to a specific spot behind a plate that's farther away. The idea that you can't hit the general vicinity of a base is just, it's the most mind-boggling thing in sports.
Yep, that's exactly the words I was going to use, mind-boggling. And it's not like he's a 25th man, you know, that can barely get the ball over a plate. This is a Cy Young contender. This is a guy who is one of the best pitchers of this era. And he can't throw the ball to first. It doesn't make any sense.
It's like in Major League 2, the catcher that can't get the ball back to the pitcher. But that's a movie, and it's a comedy movie. And he's got to look at Playboy magazines to be able to focus enough to get the ball back. Maybe that's what John Lester needs.
Do you remember Giovanni Soto?
Oh, yeah.
He had a little bit of the case of the yips where he, every time he threw the ball back to the pitcher.
Yeah, he did that weird thing.
He'd like fall over almost and like rub his hand in the dirt. And at first I thought it was like lazy. Like, what is this guy doing throwing from his knees and stuff? But like, it's the way that he can make sure that he gets the ball to that mitt, you know?
That's so weird.
You know, so maybe John Lester needs to fall down and like do something like that to throw the ball to first base.
This story from RJ Anderson, CBSSports.com. If aliens landed on Earth and asked some random folks about Chicago Cubs southpaw John Lester, the odds are they'd quickly learn that Lester has issues throwing to first base. Lester's well-known mental block impacts his ability to control the running game and field his position alike, putting more pressure on Chicago's other fielders. As such, new Cubs third base coach Brian Butterfield has been working with Lester on a potential fix for his issues. A Michael Jordan to Scottie Pippen-inspired bounce throw, per ESPN. Quote, in Butterfield's words, just eliminate all tension and bounce it over there, Lester told reporters. We've been working on it early in the morning. I don't really care what it looks like. I don't care if it bounces 72 times over there. And out's an out. Lester broke out the bounce pass during his start on Sunday, yet it caught reserve first baseman Efren Navarro by surprise, skipping by and costing the Cubs. Lester, for his part, seems committed to giving it a go once the regular season starts. So I haven't seen video of this. It's basically throwing a ground ball. Like, is that how do you make a...
Yeah, it kind of bounces twice, and I don't know.
How is that effective?
If Rizzo was over there, maybe he would have caught it, but...
But if you're a base stealer...
This was more of a... not necessarily to keep a guy close to first. It was like a bunt or a swinging bunt where he came off the mound and threw it to first base to try to get the guy who's running from home plate to first base.
Oh, so this isn't even pickoffs.
Right.
Just figure it out, dude.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say to him, too, dude.
Just figure it out, dude. This from Bob Nightingale. Ichiro Suzuki is getting close to finalizing a one-year major league deal with the Mariners. Heading back to Seattle. That's kind of cool.
That's super fun.
He seems done, though. Doesn't he?
He just seems like one of those guys that could, you know, roll out of bed and get a hit, though. I mean...
Well, he... 215 plate appearances last year with the Marlins. 255, 318, 332. Three homers and one stolen base. I don't know. If he's going for one last run, it's cool that it's in Seattle. I'm down with that.
Maybe sell some tickets, too.
Hey, Chris Mortensen reporting that the Eagles want more than the first and fourth round picks they received for Sam Bradford, for Nick Foles. I don't know, man. That Sam Bradford trade was the perfect storm for them. The Vikings needed a quarterback so bad.
Desperate.
And to me, Sam Bradford's better than Nick Foles.
Yeah, a healthy Bradford should be better than Nick Foles.
I'm impressed with what Nick Foles did. I gave him all the love in the world during the Super Bowl. He's still limited, and he's back in Philly in a system that fits him. And he's the type of quarterback. He's I say this all the time. I said this about Brian Hoyer when he was here in Chicago. He's what you want in a backup quarterback. I'm telling you, if you trade for Nick Foles right now, and you give up a first and a fourth, and they want more than that, so let's say a first and a third. Now he's in a different system. It's not going to go well, and you're going to be out a first-round pick.
Well, the Vikings weren't the first team that liked Bradford. I mean, this is a guy who won the Heisman, was a Heisman favorite before he tore his ACL in college, was the number one overall pick. I mean, he was highly touted for a long time. Nick Foles is a good quarterback and obviously, you know, good enough to help lead a team to a Super Bowl victory, but I would not bet the farm on him. You can't risk your future and trade all that for a guy who, you know, played on a really good team. I mean, that's a great defense. Some solid, you know, skill position players. I would not trade that much to get him.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. I'll tell you what I would do if I was the Vikings. I'm on record as not being a huge Kirk Cousins fan, but I think this is a great fit. I think it's a great fit. Cousins is going to get his money anyway. The market is what it is. The Vikings have the money. They need to lock down that quarterback spot before this window closes. Windows close fast in the NFL. They close really fast. They close usually a year or two earlier than you think they will. And this Vikings team needs a quarterback. And I got bad news for Bears fans and Packer fans and Lions fans. I think that's where he's ending up. I think that's what's going to end up happening. And there's been, I think Matt Miller reported today or yesterday, I think it was today, that the Vikings and the Jets are the two finalists already. There's no tampering, though. I told you last week, though, this is what happens at the combine. You get the agents and the teams all in one place, and you at least start to realize, hey, maybe that's just where Kirk Cousins wants to go. I think it's a great fit. I think he should go to Minnesota. This is from TMZ. Alden Smith has checked in the rehab. And the people who helped him get there are the parents of the alleged domestic violence victim. The embattled NFL star was involved in a domestic violence incident Saturday night when cops arrived. Smith had left the scene, and the cops are trying to locate him. TMZ spoke with Smith's fiance, who confirms she is the alleged victim in the incident, but says the most important thing to her is that Smith gets help for his substance abuse problem. I can tell you this. Alden called my parents and asked them to take him to rehab, the woman tells us. He complied. They went and got him. I was not there. My family took him and had him checked in. Hope he gets his life in order. Here's something I can relate to. This is from ABC News. Something stinks in one southeastern New Mexico town, and residents want police on the case. KRQE-TV in Albuquerque reports skunk smell is plaguing the town of Hagerman, New Mexico, thanks to a mild winter that is bringing out the smelling mammals early. Come to Vernon Hills. We have an enormous skunk problem up there. It's ridiculous. It usually hits early fall. But I've already seen them out there. Like last week when it got up to 60 for a day. It's bad.
Has your dog ever been sprayed?
No, thank God. And I don't know how she hasn't, because we let her out all the time.
Knocking on wood for anybody.
I know. You had that you had it happen?
I've never really had dogs, to be honest, but my cousin's dog has been sprayed a few times.
Ugh.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, man, the skunk to human ratio, the skunk to dog ratio is such that I don't know how it hasn't happened. And I thought for a while there was one under our front porch last year.
We had that once.
And I looked up some remedy, and it may have worked, but it may not have. There's something under there, I know. We keep the dog in the back, but I think Dave Ennett's dog got sprayed once.
Yeah, it's not a fun thing to deal with.
Yeah. Kobe Bryant won an Oscar. That's really the story. He's
got the leg up on LeBron and MJ now.
So he wrote these poems about basketball, correct? And then someone made it into a film. And it won an Oscar. It's like short film, right?
Yeah, he won best short film. Maybe even best animated short film.
Yeah. I want to get an Oscar. Good for Kobe. And here's Kobe talking about winning an Oscar.
I feel better than winning a championship, to be honest with you. I swear I do. It's you know, growing up as a kid, I dreamt of winning championships, you know, and working really hard to make that dream come true. But then, like, to have something like this seemingly come out of left field, you know, and like, you know, I heard a lot of people tell me when I started writing, and they would ask me, what are you going to do when you retire? And I'd say, well, I want to be a writer. I want to be a storyteller. And I got a lot of, yeah, that's cute. That's cute. You'll be depressed when your career is over and you'll come back to play, you know. And I got that a lot. And so to be here right now and to have like a sense of validation is, dude, this is crazy, man. It's crazy.
Not only that, after the win, you don't have to sit in a tub of ice.
I don't. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Come on, man. You spend your whole life playing basketball, and the NBA Finals has to seem better.
Yeah, maybe a room full of people covering the Oscars made him feel like he had to pump it up a little, but
yeah.
This is one of the most competitive guys of our lifetime. And he's going to say that an Oscar is better than a championship?
What is with these sports guys crossing over? I'm looking at the monitor right now on WGN-TV. Jesse Palmer's hosting the Daily Mail TV. That's a thing? I didn't know that. And he's talking to Kevin Frazier, used to work at ESPN. What's going on? Jesse Palmer's a quarterback and a college football analyst.
Well, we started our sports show talking about the Oscars.
Yeah, but I started the sports show talking about how the Oscars are stupid.
Maybe that's what Jesse's saying.
I'm doing a whole pop culture show and how I just think they're boring. I'm not taking anything against from the award. The award's cool, man. I'd love to have an Oscar. I'll never have one. I shouldn't have one. All right. Later on this week, I'll be in Arizona. We'll have spring training coverage for you. We'll be checking out the White Sox for a few days. But until then, still be here tomorrow. I think Kevin Powell will probably sit in tomorrow with me. And I don't know what we're going to talk about right now. We'll figure it out, though. We have 23 hours to do so. And until then, we'll talk to you then on Sports Central.